Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs, bringing you 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live right now and then you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need, fast and focused. It's Wednesday, the 28th of August, coming up on the program. The Justice Minister VBS fraud scandal intensifies. Now the President's office weighs into the debate. The shocking state of South African municipal audits, why older middle-class people are opting for apartment retirement, and 50% of women in middle management roles believe they will not achieve their career goals. It's being reported that under pressure Justice Minister Thembi Simelane is now seeking clarification over allegations around her links to the VBS Mutual Bank. So the big question, I guess, is can she survive the scandal and what impact is this having broadly on the justice system and the wider optics? I want to give you an expert view on that. Mbeki Zili Benjamin is with us now from the organization Judges Matter. He is Research and Advocacy Officer. And let's wade straight into this with a note from President Ramaphosa's office today, now wanting clarification and answers from the beleaguered Justice Minister. Obviously something to be welcomed, and welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Jeremy. It's a pleasure to be on the program. Yes, it is absolutely to be welcomed. It is an important step because that is exactly what we as civil society organizations are calling for, that the minister must play open cards with the public. She must explain her role in this situation. She must explain the circumstances of the loan, how she came about to obtain the loan, what were the relevant documents, a loan agreement or any other proof that this loan was above board, and exactly what she did to settle the loan. Because all of this is important, as you mentioned, the optics of it all. Our number one anti-corruption crusader shouldn't really be involved in any way in a scandal that is undoubtedly the biggest corruption scandal in the country. So for us, we welcome the president's calling in of the minister to explain, and we hope that the minister will also take the public into confidence.
But again, the president's office has no choice but to respond to this, but the argument always remains. He's leaving it a bit late, isn't he?
Well, not necessarily. It's only been about 48 hours since this scandal broke. And so I think, to be fair to him, he's acted much faster than we've seen in the past. Obviously, the minister has left it a little bit late, because one would have expected that 24 hours into the scandal, we should have gotten some form of communication from the ministry. And we should emphasize here, Jeremy, that at this stage, we are not accusing the minister of corruption. But certainly this scandal or the allegations are quite serious. And so one does expect, especially for someone who is in such a sensitive position as Justice Minister when it comes to corruption, that she will be as transparent as possible. And obviously, the faster she acts, the more confidence we can have in her.
In your opinion, how does this perceived conflict of interest, given her oversight of the NPA, affect public trust in the justice system?
Well, it is a huge danger to public trust. It completely undermines, if there's any credibility to the allegations, it completely undermines her role as someone who has oversight over institutions like the National Prosecuting Authority, which is supposed to prosecute any allegations in the VBS saga, institutions like the Special Investigating Unit, which also has its own role in investigating this. But more importantly, and for us, the concern is that the minister sits on the Magistrates Commission. The minister sits on the Judicial Service Commission, and in both those institutions, she plays a central role in the appointment of magistrates and judges who will be at the end tasked with adjudicating cases of corruption. So it is a huge risk to have someone tainted in corruption allegations to be sitting at such a strategic position. So for us, that is the major concern.
Do you think this is also a failure of due diligence preceding her appointment?
I think that might be too harsh because at the time, look, she was mayor of the municipality, and later on she served a full term as minister at COCTA. So it really was shifting her from one position to the other. So I don't think that the due diligence would have stretched to that point. Obviously, would have welcomed such an intensive scrutiny, but I don't think it would have been reasonable in the president's calculations that he would have stretched that far in examining the minister's record. But of course, it was, even if the loan was above board, it was an oversight on her part to do business with someone who does business with the municipality that she oversees, but particularly someone who's now been found to have been quite intimately involved in VPS.
But at the very least, an upfront declaration, surely.
It would, yes, absolutely. She should have been more careful in declaring these things, especially as it relates to a private business, because it does give rise to a conflict of interest and the risk is too great. She should have been upfront in declaring this to the president. But I think, like I said, on the president's part, it might be too strong to say he should have done an extra due diligence.
To the best of your knowledge, is there legal precedent that exists for a sitting minister facing similar charges?
To my recollection, there isn't, but we know from previous public protector investigations, there have been circumstances where the private interests of the member of the executive do conflict with their public role. An easy example is the Palapala investigation involving the president, the Bosasa investigation involving the president's son. All of those are examples where we saw private or business interests of the executive now conflicting with their public role. And that kind of thing shouldn't happen, really, in a governance system such as ours. We should expect our executives to pay quite close attention to the Executive Ethics Code, and more so for the Minister of Justice. And for us working in the space, in the justice space, we sort of have a lot of trust in our minister, and we hope that they will always have the interests of the justice system at the forefront of their minds, and anything that might raise a red flag concerning their role should be paid attention to. And in this case, it doesn't look like there was.
Well, talking of red flags, there's also going to be an interesting one for legal scholars in the way in which the law differentiates between a legitimate commercial loan and a transaction that constitutes corruption. As you're intimating, there is a fine line there.
Yeah, well, that is work for the public protector to determine, and it would be interesting to see where she draws the line. But certainly, from what the media reports suggest, there are questions to be answered, and there are documents that should be produced by the minister, and we hope that she will play open cards and sort of declare all of that information.
I sense the story has still got a long way to run. Thank you very much indeed, Mbekezile Benjamin, Research and Advocacy Officer at Judges Matter.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, no real change here. Poor local government audit outcomes continue. Only 34 of South Africa's 257 municipalities obtaining clean bills of health. The Auditor General releasing the 2022-23 consolidated general report on local government audit outcomes, saying, and I quote, no meaningful improvement has occurred over the first 2 years of the current term. That's not good news. Well, joining us now is Lerato Pasha, Acting Chief Officer, Municipal Finance, Trading Services and Local Economic Development at the South African Local Government Association. Welcome. And first up, why have the audit outcomes from local municipalities, in your opinion, shown little improvement?
Yeah, the challenges in municipalities are quite multiple, and this includes also the support that we've been offering to municipalities as part of the intergovernmental relations stakeholders. And I think to mention one of the few challenges that we have observed was the high vacancy rate in the CFO positions or management positions within the finance departments of municipalities, the skills and capacity and capability, which has also given rise to the dependency in consulting and the value that municipalities spend in from consulting companies. The fragmented support that I've actually elaborated that, you know, there is no national program that brings all the key players to have a more differentiated and a more collaborative and concerted effort in addressing the different categories of municipalities that are getting different audit opinions. That there has been, you know, great strides that have been made in the program that addresses municipalities that have been receiving disclaimer audit opinions. And I think we have seen a significant improvements of 45% reduction of municipalities in that area. But I think now it needs to be scaled up to other audit opinions so that we can see the scaled up or more improvement in our areas. And the AG has raised with us that, you know, one of the long-hanging fruits is within the areas of where municipalities are receiving unqualified audit opinions, because the issues or the findings thereof are not as many as the rest of the audit opinions. And this is an area that we can focus on. And if you can see, I think there's 110 municipalities that are receiving those audit opinions. And if you can do that, we'll be able to maybe achieve the impact in terms of improving and they can move up to clean audit, because the ultimate goal is we want to see municipalities achieving clean audits and not any other audit opinion. The other issue is the issue of performance management that is not necessarily cascaded down to lower levels, because the issue of audit is about how the organization has been implementing or servicing their communities and how the money has been spent thereof. So you have a layer of senior managers that are only on performance contracts or also performance managed. But the lower levels needs to also be cascaded down so that the issue of accountability and consequence management that is provided by council and Section 79 committees, it's able to be activated and institutionalized in the manner that everybody knows that if I don't perform, there'll be consequences towards that.
Do you have the sense sometimes that in spite of the fact that you've outlined a very comprehensive way forward, do you have a sense sometimes that the municipalities, particularly those who are recalcitrant, that are not achieving those audits, are either ignoring the AG or are simply not in a position to act speedily on the problem?
It's in two ways. There has been municipalities where it's what we called audit action plans that are drafted and approved by council for them to take action and really resolve what the AG has raised. And you would find that those municipalities has not done or acted on those implementing those actions. But there are those municipalities that there's simply no capacity internally to even implement the resolution internally so that they resolve those findings. So it's in two folds. There are those that internally, especially municipalities in smaller and rural, where they're unable to attract the kind of skills that is required to manage their finance departments and overall the municipality in general.
In Salga's opinion, how does the continued poor audit performance of some municipalities impact ratepayers who depend on those services?
It's how they're impacted is because the audit opinions are reflecting that the finances are not managed in terms of the laws and regulations. Obviously, that will discourage the consumers in believing and having confidence in the municipalities that the money that they've been paid, they're paying, it's not really being allocated to the use that it was intended for. And it was the laws and the regulations have not been complied with. That is one important aspect, that the confidence of the consumers, and that might discourage them not to want to pay, because they don't believe that the money that has been collected from them is going towards, you know, service delivery, maintenance of infrastructure, and obviously also trying to see how the municipality can invest back into refurbishing the current infrastructure.
And if the current trajectory continues in that respect, more and more ratepayers are going to become aggrieved and are going to suggest that they hold back funding, which will have a catastrophic impact on local government.
Definitely, most definitely, and we don't want that to happen. That's why we are now, I think, from a national through presidency, they have tasked DCOG to start leading the interministerial and intergovernmental programs, that we need to find each other in terms of coordinating these programs, so that we can be able to specifically for specific problems, how we are addressing together with municipalities in improving, not just in the area of finance, but in the area of service delivery. And we are hoping, because it has never been happened at a national level, particularly with municipal audit support. It has always been fragmented. SALGA, National Treasury and DCOG, we've only been doing our individual programs that are so fragmented, and that is, I think, part of the reason why we were unable to really make the impact in terms of supporting municipalities and seeing them out of these not so good audit.
Well, thank you very much indeed for a very frank and blunt assessment there. Lerato Pasha, Acting Chief Officer, Municipal Finance at the South African Local Government Association. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, as we move on, there might be a slightly personal angle to the next story, and I am going to ask for your indulgence. Downsizing and retirement often go together, and apartments in secure estates are becoming a popular option for active seniors. This is particularly true for those who want to live on the coast while also enjoying the freedom to travel when they want. It's an interesting trend, and I'm going to talk now to Barto van der Merwe, Managing Director of Renishaw Property Developments. Welcome to you. And how prevalent then is this downsizing trend?
No, I think it's very prevalent. I think as you grow older and you retire, you obviously need to scale down. And we all live in bigger houses when we have families, and scaling down at, you know, close to the coast just makes sense. We don't need the bigger space, and it's just easier to maintain if it's smaller. It's more cost effective, and often you can buy in a secure estate where there's obviously security that goes hand in hand with that.
How important is location in this respect, and particularly within the properties that you operate in?
Yeah, I think location is very important. I think COVID has obviously changed things considerably with respect to working. Many people move to the coast nowadays. Sort of semigration that everybody speaks about is definitely still happening. And I think even if you are in your 50s, people can already sort of move towards a scaling down close to the coast, but still continue working. And I think people would like to be in more serene environments, like close to the coast, as opposed to a heavily built-up city environment.
Of course, you've got to be cognizant of cost considerations when downsizing. What advice can you share in that respect?
Yeah, I think when you downscale, obviously, you know, you're buying a smaller unit, and therefore the cost will be lower. I think quality is something that's obviously very important to everybody. I think one must be careful, you know, not to just look at the bottom line price, but to exactly, you know, analyze what you're paying for and make sure that you get the best value for money. Yeah, as they say, you know, just a smaller bottom line is not always the right answer.
I guess as well that you've also got to think slightly longer term in this respect, and take into consideration the importance of resale value in apartments. So you might have bought downsized, but at some point you might want to downsize even further. And that has got to be a primary consideration, surely.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think when choosing a location, one needs to consider, I suppose, the age of that development, but not just the development, also the area as a whole. If you buy into an estate that's younger, in an area that's up and coming, I think you'll achieve better growth over the initial years because of the delta that exists between that price bracket and those that are more established. So I think that's important. So there's a little bit more risk in that, of course, but I think the reward is also bigger.
You talk about looking for location that is up and coming. How do you make that determination, Bato?
Well, I think you need to look at the trend, what new developments have been started in the recent years. Have they been successful? Look at the growth rate within that estate compared to maybe the other houses in the town. How does it compare in terms of growth rate? That's what I would say, yeah.
And what advice would you give to someone considering selling their larger home to downsize, particularly regarding timing and current market conditions? What are you seeing in that respect?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think in terms of current market conditions, I think everybody seem to be moving to the Western Cape. Property seem to be booming there, and prices are relatively high. But I think, when you look at value for money, I think listeners should also consider other locations, maybe like KZN, where KZN has faced many sort of challenges over the last number of years. But I think that's maybe the place to invest when it's at its lowest. And I think we'll get your best growth over the sort of short to medium term in those locations as opposed to the Western Cape, again, where there's less risk. But I think you will probably find that the rate of growth will be slightly less there over the long term.
And I'm sure a question that you asked very often is around concern regarding accessibility and space for people, particularly when you've downsized from a bigger home. Often that adaptation can be very difficult, surely.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think it's a big move, mentally to move from your family home to downscale to a sort of retirement setup. So I think, first of all, you need to get over that mentally. In terms of the actual space, I think it'd be good to, get rid of some of those older furniture, sell it or give it to your kids. I think they'll enjoy getting those quality furniture. And it's maybe time to buy something a little bit more appropriate for the new home. Make sure that it fits well into the space that you're buying. But, if you buy into a secure estate, there's often, bigger facilities within the estate, like a community center that hosts various clubs like Canesta and bowling and even archery. So I think it's important to consider that you're not just going to sit in your unit. There'll be other things that you can do. And I think you need to consider the other facilities that's available in the estate that you're buying into so that you don't just have to sit in the unit.
And just be very aware of hidden costs like extra maintenance levies, for instance.
Absolutely. It's sometimes difficult to compare levies. It's not always apples for apples. So I think it's important to, whenever speaking to a developer, just get a full analysis of what you'll be paying for. And again, don't just look at the bottom line. See what's included in that and what's excluded from that. Some estates include garden services, as well as all the maintenance on the outside of the unit, as well as sometimes fiber, internet connection. So, and others don't offer that. So don't just look at the bottom line, but do an analysis of your levy.
Yeah, well, it certainly is an increasing trend. And thank you very much for sharing those insights. Bato van der Merwe, thank you indeed. Managing Director, Renishaw Property Developments. Appreciate the time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Attention, all investors and finance enthusiasts. Get ready for the annual Money Summit, Africa's largest and most influential savings and investment event. Join me, Jeremy Maggs, on Tuesday, the 10th of September at the Sandton Convention Center as we connect with over 100 top chief executives and industry leaders across 20 exciting conferences and forums, all in one incredible day. Secure your spot now. Register online at www.moneysummit.co.za for free with the code MoneyWebGuest. This is your chance to be part of Africa's premier savings and investment event. Don't miss it.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And let me finish with this. About half of women in middle management roles in two sectors surveyed, that's legal and financial, believe they will not be able to achieve their career goals at their current employers. And that's according to new research from the Henley Business School Africa. It underscores, I guess, a potential crisis for female empowerment in business in this country. More now from Despina Senatore, who is executive fellow at Henley and one of the authors of the new white paper on women in leadership. And firstly then, what are the reasons behind this disconnect, do you think?
As mentioned in the report, there's multiple reasons. And the unfortunate thing is that, you know, this is nothing new. So when we say half the participants, when we ask them, do you think you'll achieve your aspirations? Because it's not like they're not interested in achieving. They want to progress in their careers. They're just saying that they're not going to get it in their current organizations. And the reasons are multifaceted. It's around mentorship and sponsorship programs. It's around whether or not the organization is really making deliberate effort to increase women representation in senior leadership. It's around patriarchal systems. It's a whole lot of things that are not new, if I can put it that way. There's a lot of studies that have been done, and they all point to the same thing.
When you talk about not enough effort being made, particularly by people who would be able to enable that promotion, if you understand what I'm saying. What are they doing wrong, and how do you then try and change that particular approach, if in fact you can, or is all of this just too entrenched, do you think?
Yeah, so that's a difficult one. I don't think that, you know, the people that are in positions to make the change wake up in the morning and say, how can we make it difficult for women to progress in the organization? I don't think that's the intention. I just think that maybe it's not top of mind. Maybe it's not being discussed at the right levels or in the right meetings. And I think also if you have a minority of representation, you know, how much of a change can you actually make? So I think it's about seeing this as a strategic imperative, which may not be the case. So I don't think that there is sufficient conversations happening around this topic. And I think it's also about understanding that this shouldn't be a tick box exercise. It should be viewed as, we know that research shows that if you have diversity in senior leadership positions, organizations do better. They are more financially successful. So how do we change the narrative around this? Touched on it in the paper. It's around how do you change the stereotypes around the roles of men and women in terms of childcare and all of that, because I think that is a huge implication as well.
I still find all of this very hard to believe, given that the time that we're working in right now.
I know.
And given how much pressure there is being applied to this particular debate. It's very demoralizing, isn't it?
I don't know about demoralizing. I think for me it was just very disappointing. As you say, we're in this day and age and we're still having this conversation. It shouldn't be a conversation that we're having. And yet it still is. And I don't know if it's more sinister or cynical to say that maybe people in power just don't want to give up power. Maybe we can talk about the political side of it as well. But it is for me, especially as a mom of a girl, and I'm sure for many other parents who have daughters, you know, to think that this is still a battle that we're fighting today.
You talk about changing the narrative within corporate South Africa, and particularly, I guess, in the two sectors that you studied, financial services and legal. How do you do that? How do you open a new line of discussion, do you think, in order to light a real fuse here?
So I think it's making it a normal conversation. I think that, and it's from my experience as well, you know, having worked in corporate, it's not something that we speak about. So how do we normalize that? How do we make it okay to talk about the challenges that women face as mothers, for instance, you know, and how do we make it a normal conversation to say, well, how can men in corporate start seeing their roles not only as primary breadwinners, as society would have us view them, but also as active parents, so that we can have a bit more of a balance, so that women have an opportunity to focus on their careers, and men can also have an opportunity to be more present or active in their families' lives. And I think it's about starting that conversation, and that's what we're trying to encourage, is start having these human conversations around what it's like to be a parent or a human being in a corporate environment.
And as maybe controversial as this might sound, on the other side of the coin, do you think that women too often accept the status quo and are not pushing hard enough for the recognition that you're suggesting they not only deserve, but need to strive for?
Yeah, so I remember when I started an initiative in the company that I was working in, I got to the point where I thought to myself, we've been too complacent as women. We're just accepting that this is the norm. And unless we start talking about it and challenging that norm, you know, things are just going to stay the way they are. So I do feel that we need to, as women, start making a bit more noise about it and not feeling shy or under pressure to keep quiet. I think if we want to see changes, we need to start being a bit more activist in, you know, without being pushy or whiny or anything like that, but just to start having more deliberate conversations around this.
But I've covered this particular issue so often in my broadcasting career, and often the reply I get to that question is there is risk in making too much noise, and it's just easier for me to stick to my lane. And that in itself is also problematic, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. But the interesting thing that came through in the interviews was that the women felt that, you know, the newer generation of leaders, the younger, so I don't know if we're talking about Gen Z or millennials or whatever, when they start stepping up and getting into more senior leadership positions, they're the ones that are going to start effecting some change. Because I think if we look at the Gen X's, I don't even know if boomers are still in leadership positions, they are more structured, right? Whereas the newer generation, they want the flexibility. I think they've been also raised by parents who are both working, as opposed to my generation where the mom stayed at home and the dad was the one who was working. Mm-hmm. So I also think that it's almost like we need the new generation to come in. The unfortunate thing is that for those of us who are already in the positions now, it just makes it more difficult for us, or we just have to be the ones who are paving the way for the next generation.
Despina, just for the record, let me just say that there are still a few of us boomers around. just need to put that out there.
I didn't mean no disrespect.
What about the role of female leaders within an organization? There's often the criticism that they themselves have climbed very hard to the top. They've broken through the glass ceiling, and they themselves would be happy with the status quo. What do they need to do in order to change the dynamic or the narrative?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's the problem, that there aren't enough of them, right? And so you get to the top there, and it's also quite a lonely place to be. I think it's about being the catalysts again, being the contrarians in the room, being the ones to say that we need to make a change. And again, it's also difficult, you know, because the minority, right? We talk about the 30% club. If you're less than 30%, your voice isn't heard. But I think it's about those women trying to be role models, trying to be examples. And we do have some of those women in corporate South Africa. When you look at the likes of Amelia Beattie, the CEO of the JSE.
Dr. Leila Faree, yeah.
Yes, there are those women who are, you know, trying to be the voices, I think. But how do we elevate their voices? And how do we get men to also, you know, be allies for women as well? It's not an easy topic. And if it was, I don't think we'd be having this discussion even in 2024. It's a very difficult conversation to have. And it's a very slow pace of, you know, progress that we're seeing because I think it's so entrenched.
Well, it certainly isn't a new conversation, but it is an important one. And Despina Senatore, Executive Fellow, Henley Business School, thank you very much indeed. And that conversation also informs our online poll today. 50% of women in middle management roles believe they will not achieve their career goals. So what do you think? Does that sound about right? Probably more, or do you think the number is exaggerated? If you have a view on that, you can participate either on our X or LinkedIn pages. That's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.